You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of the issue's cover story, 321 Dua, by Aaron Vanderhoof. To American listeners, Lipa's success may seem to have come from nowhere, but her story is one of continent-crossing perseverance, a bit of luck, and one of those generational pop personalities who simply will not be denied. Future nostalgia would have been an unusual record even if it hadn't arrived at the beginning of a global crisis. It takes a buffet table approach to the sonic decorations from decades worth of disco, funk, and synth pop, while also showcasing Lipa's keen ear for complex vocal melodies and her distinctively raspy and lithe voice. It marries the efficiency of structured pop with the curiosity of dance music, yet in between pulsing bass lines and naturalistic percussion, it's full of silence. Little spaces here and there that telegraph a breath before a song blooms into something new. Its emotional and dynamic range is broad, yet it all passes by effortlessly. The record's title came to Lipa before anything else. She almost used Future Nostalgia as a backdrop for a 2018 awards show performance before deciding that she wanted to save it for something special. "I loved jumping into what felt like a story," she said. "I really loved the idea of Future Nostalgia having its own world." Though Lipa worked with a long list of collaborators on the album, a core group of contributors from her 2017 debut, including songwriter Clarence Coffey Jr. and producer-writer Stephen Kosminiak, returned to the studio with her for the Future Nostalgia sessions in summer 2018. Both said that the experience of working with Lipa is marked primarily by how fun it is. "I have summer camp vibes with one of my best friends," Coffey told me. Kaz was one of the first people she told about the title, and he said it was helpful in nailing a sonic palette. Lipa was struggling to express exactly how it would translate into music until a session where she, Coffey, Kaz, and songwriter Sarah Hudson wrote Levitating, which would eventually become the album's sixth single and a major hit. The bones of the song are audible on the first voice memo they recorded, and with the help of donuts and plenty of playing around, it came together in about a day. The difference with Dua's project, compared to a lot of other projects, "it feels like you're in a little band," Kaz said of the song. "I can still hear what the day was. I can hear the laughs. I can hear the jokes. It was a riot." Hudson and Coffey eventually gave Lipa a nameplate necklace that reads Sugaboo, the group's studio term of endearment that made its way into the song's chorus. "Their bond," Lipa said, "makes constructive criticism much easier. In that way, it's also a strategy for keeping out doubt. There was just this pressure," Lipa said, "people just telling me that I wasn't good enough or that I wasn't deserving of it, or whatever it was. I was like, all right, I'm just going to shut everything out, and I'm going to make sure that I get this album the way that I want it to, and I'm really just going to focus on being great at everything that I do." Lipa was born in London in 1995, about 3 years after her parents, Dukayin and Anissa, immigrated from Pristina, a mid-sized city in Kosovo, then still part of Yugoslavia. Though the war that would make Kosovo a matter of global concern wouldn't begin until 1998, Pristina in 1995 was already a difficult place to live for its ethnic Albanian majority. Dua's grandfather, Sait Lipa, was head of the Institute for the History of Kosovo when it was targeted for closure by Serbian law in 1992. A move that a special rapporteur for the United Nations later called a sign of burgeoning human rights violations. In London, where the family joined a growing exodus from Kosovo, Lipa's parents spoke Albanian and raised her with an awareness of their culture. Dukajin is a musician, and Lipa remembers a house full of music. In December, Anesa told CBS Sunday Morning that her daughter seemed destined to be a performer early on, and when I asked Lipa about it, she said, "Probably the amount of times I annoyingly interrupted her dinners at home with friends and was like, 'I'm going to put on a show now.'" "Everything was Albanian at home, and English was my school life," Lipa said. "I had so much family in Kosovo, but also because of the situation and not being able to go back, I had never really met my family." Because she was young during the open conflict that lasted until the summer of 1999, Lipa didn't know much about it. "I guess my parents also didn't want to upset me at such a young age," she said. "After the war, my dad's father passed away, and my dad couldn't make it back in time, because obviously all the borders were closed. But it was just one of those things they didn't tell me until a little bit later on." Still, Lipa always had a sense that she had another place to return to, and was excited when the family, which by then included her younger siblings, Rina and Gin, moved back when she was 11. "I was returning to a place where I almost already felt I belonged," she said. "It was really exciting for me to get to go to a place where also I felt in some way I would be more normal." In Pristina, she became an amateur anthropologist of a culture she was already a part of. "It started with the larger things, like realizing that her Albanian wasn't yet up to snuff for academic work, and struggling through a few years of bad grades. She also started to learn, via her friends, more about the region's conflict." "These stories, they stay with you forever," she said. "The people that they'd lost during the war, and the amount of friends I had that had lost their fathers or their uncles or brothers, or how people were violently taken away from their homes." She made friends and watched the way teenagers in the city coalesced in Mother Teresa Square. In the mid-aughts, a few prominent businessmen realized that bringing international artists to the country could help reassure the world that Kosovo was safe. Because hip-hop was easily the most popular genre there, 50 Cent became the first major star to perform in Pristina's stadium in 2007. That shows success led to more, and Lipa saw a pretty impressive list of American rappers, such as Method Man and Redman and Snoop Dogg, in concert before the age of 15. It was an early exposure to what it means when music functions as a universal language. Lipa credits her time in Pristina with instilling her with political convictions. Though her music isn't explicit on the topic, and her persona as a pop star is slick and playful, she's always been willing to take a side, even when it could spark controversy. Those who watch her closely will have noticed her full-throated support for Black Lives Matter, her enthusiasm for voting Labour in 2019, and her persistence in celebrating her Albanian identity despite occasional negative reactions to the symbology she's used to express it. "It mainly came because of my roots in Kosovo and wanting to take a stand on that and talk about that and the refugee situation. And then slowly starting to understand how, you know, the politics of war, how all that happens, why so many children are displaced," she said. Things stemmed from a personal experience into then wanting to learn more and trying to also be a voice for lots of other people. It's also a matter of using the platform she regards as a privilege. As my profile is growing, especially online, I feel like I need to use that to do something better than, you know, posting cute pictures or whatever. In the weeks after our interview, Lipa continued to voice support for Palestinians suffering in Gaza and in the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah as conflict erupted in both areas. In late May, a pro-Israel group called the World Values Network attacked Lipa, along with models and sisters of her boyfriend Anwar, Bella and Gigi Hadid, who are of Palestinian descent, in a rambling full-page New York Times ad that attempted to conflate Lipa's stance with anti-Semitism. In a social media response, Lipa reiterated her principles of solidarity and justice. There was no question that she would remain committed to using that platform to speak on the issue. Lipa's political engagement, especially on the cause of universal health care, has led her to a friendship with U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders. She campaigned for Sanders during his bid for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2020, hosted video chats with him during the run-up to the general election, and he presented her with an award at the Billboard ceremony in December. Sanders took great umbrage with the ads. "The attacks against Dua are outrageous," Sanders said, simply saying that we must uphold international standards of human rights consistently, even when it's politically difficult, is not anti-Semitism. The time is now to adopt an even-handed approach in the conflict, one that says Israel has the absolute right to live in peace and security, but so do the Palestinians. It is good that we are seeing the rise of a new generation of leaders like Dua, who are speaking out in support of building a society based on human needs and political equality. Lipa was 12 and watching on TV in the family flat when Kosovo declared independence in February 2008. I remember seeing the joy of my parents and my family and everybody, hearing the whole city roaring when Independence Day happened, she said. But still, she felt a pull back to London. A few years later, she came up with a plan to return to the UK by herself. Her motivations were complex, but at their core, she thought it gave her the best chance of making it as a musician. Despite a decade of progress, Kosovo was still isolated and underdeveloped, and social media hadn't yet transformed talent discovery. Lipa said she had to convince her parents with a little conversation at a time, but they eventually agreed when they realized she could move into an apartment with a family friend who was studying at the London School of Economics. At 15, she left Pristina alone. She said that maybe she would have made a different choice if streaming had been the alternative route to mainstream success it is now, but it's clear she was happy to return to England. Talking to her, one gets the distinct sense of dual Duas. If being an Albanian Kosovar is her ethnic identity, being British is her personality. It comes across in the small things, her enthusiasm for the NHS, her commitment to waiting her turn for the coronavirus vaccine, and her support for other young British artists like Arlo Parks, whose song Eugene she sang on BBC Radio 1's Live Lounge in April, and in the bigger ones, like her sheer love for the City of London. "I feel like my life will always be between two places," she said. Her solo move to London has become part of her lore because it was gutsy, and it's made all the more impressive by the fact that it worked out almost exactly as she planned. She gave herself 1 year after finishing secondary school to find representation before considering another career path. Lipa was waiting tables in Soho and using her YouTube channel of cover songs as a portfolio when a friend helped her get a meeting with Mawson, a former entertainment lawyer who pivoted to management when he began working with Lana Del Rey. She came into the room, and she didn't have much to play in the way of music, but it was her personality that drew me to her, Mawson said. She didn't quite know what she wanted in granular terms, but the big picture was very clear, and the ambition. He's been her manager ever since. Lipa started piecing together an album over years of sessions, yielding about 160 songs with a wide array of songwriters. I was just putting songs out in the hopes that they would just have a little bit more momentum than the last song, she said. Baby steps. Just a little bit more than the other ones. Just a couple more people. Sell out one more show or have the rooms fill up. Just a little bit more. At 18, Lipa was usually the youngest person in the room. Kosminiuk, who co-wrote or produced four tracks on Future Nostalgia, first met her when she went to Toronto in October 2014. Kaz recalled being impressed by her cool, loving personality, her voice, and her slight air of mystery. It was just something so compelling right off the bat, he said. Other situations can be toxic, especially in the music business. So when you find little situations where it can be honest, where there's freedom, people don't get bent out of shape, it's nice. Those early sessions were a proving ground for Lipa, who was well aware of the pitfalls and boxes that await young women breaking into the industry. I was constantly being like, this is me, and I'm not manufactured, she said. But it takes a lot of growth and time and effort and all of that until you get to a point where people say, okay, I believe you. In the run-up to the release of her album in June 2017, she gained early traction with a mostly European audience as part of a wave of young female Brits who mixed EDM influences with bubbly pop songwriting. It wasn't until a month after its release when a female empowerment slumber party video for New Rules, the album's seventh single, went viral and brought the song to an American audience that she really distinguished herself as an artist with a vision. By the end of 2017, she had become Spotify's most streamed female artist in the UK, and by early 2018, the song had hit the Hot 100, peaking at number 6. Global impact was part of the plan from the beginning, said Mawson. There are a lot of British artists who count successes in the UK, but we're very much focused on the world, so we have that in mind when we work on music, he added. If we don't have an American radio team totally confident, it's not going to be a single. The momentum allowed Lipa to go into the studio for her second album with a new degree of freedom. Now I'm really allowed to do whatever the F I want, she told GQ in January 2018. But it also brought scrutiny. Over the course of 2018, a few backhanded YouTube comments and awkward performance clips became memes that had unusual staying power, even if their implication was a bit inscrutable. One of the most lasting ones, Go Girl, Give Us Nothing, on a video of her at the 2018 Brit Awards, could be read as praise for her enrapturing nonchalance on stage, which really is different from the sillier person you might see on Instagram. But to Lipa, it also reflected what she saw as her own shortcomings in the period as her popularity ramped up and her schedule was stuffed. It's one thing when people are mean about you, but you know that you did your best, she said. But it's another thing when people are mean about you, and you know that you actually haven't had the opportunity to be the best, because you've spread yourself so thinly in trying to do everything at once. Though Lipa did take the criticism personally, she mentioned the nothing comment specifically. Her takeaway is telling. You want to show that you're here to stay, and you want to show that it's not just about one album or one big song or whatever it is, she said. I just wanted to make sure that this time around I was very much in control of the fact that I'm going to do the music, that I'm going to rehearse. And then when I come in and I do the performances, they're all going to be amazing, I'm going to prove to people that I can do this and that I'm here to stay. In March 2020, Lipa was on her way back to London from promoting the album in Australia. She was looking forward to spending a few weeks at home with Anwar Hadid, whom she began seeing in June 2019. Her return, it turns out, was a harbinger of the year to come. I open the front door to my house, and all of a sudden, I can hear this water trickling, and my whole apartment, it had flooded. A pipe had burst above her apartment. So when she performed Don't Start Now on March 30th on James Corden's late night show, she was doing it from a precarious setup in an Airbnb. The Zoom call-esque production, which featured Lipa accompanied by her band and dancers in separate video squares, was a hit in those early quarantine days, when late night TV and the rest of the world was still on its heels. It was a really small little studio flat, she said. I was balancing my iPhone on my laptop, using the little oven lights from behind to give me some ambiance. By the time she appeared on The Tonight Show a little over a week later, she was more confident and began to experiment with the form. The resulting performance played up the novelty of it all with a filter and green screen effect. With the help of her team, she kept coming up with more workarounds. It seemed to distract her from the dislocation she felt being away from home and the stress of moving three more times during the UK's first lockdown. Otherwise, it was a peaceful escape for the couple, where they indulged in a love of the card game Uno, did some painting, and enjoyed the unseasonably pleasant English springtime. "We got lucky," she said. "Lots of being out in the garden, reading a book, and just chilling and listening to music." Even before the pandemic, Lipa and Hadid had never spent more than 2 weeks apart, unusual for a bicontinental relationship. On their respective Instagrams, Lipa and Hadid share a preternatural sense of cool and a few quirks from their upbringings. Anwar is half Dutch, so he's also quite European in some senses, she said. In keeping with her general policy for posting on social media, she asked Hadid before sharing any photos of him, though she isn't necessarily upset if he doesn't do the same. "I always like to ask if he likes a picture before I post it, but I also think sometimes it's sweet that he really likes kind of ugly pictures of me," she said. "And I look at him and I'm like, really? And he's like, I love it. And then I let him post it, although I hate it." When the lockdown lifted in July, Lipa and Hadid returned to the U.S. after a brief quarantine in the Caribbean, and she got back to in-person work with strict precautions. First came Club Future Nostalgia, a remix album helmed by Maria Stamper, who DJs as the Blessed Madonna, which gave her an opportunity to extend the life of the record a bit. Learn more about the technical aspects of remixing and work with a few dream collaborators like Madonna and Gwen Stefani. Lipa's sense of what will work on the dance floor and her ability to translate that around the world is reminiscent of Kylie Minogue, the Australian artist whose long career has made her the doyenne of dance-forward pop songs. So it's only natural that Minogue took an interest in Lipa once she encountered her music. Eventually, the two met and were able to collaborate in a distinctly 21st century way, in a busy frenzy of remixes and Minogue's guest appearance on Studio 2054, a live stream concert that attracted 5 million viewers in November. "I think it works with how so many people hear music now," Minogue told Vanity Fair of the circumstances that led her to work with Lipa. "She's delivering quality all the way, and I totally appreciate that, even though she is making it look easy. It takes a lot of hard work and devotion." As Mawson pointed out, Lipa and her team were lucky to release the album at a time when other pop stars had decided to wait things out. Still, something about Future Nostalgia seems tailor-made for a moment when traditional sources of fun have shut down, but you still need joy as a lifeline. Lipa lights up when she reminisces about the impromptu gatherings she's seen coalesce around her. Those teenage hangs in Mother Teresa Square, watching the 2014 World Cup broadcast in London. Before the pandemic, she would throw dinner parties and turn her apartment into a dance floor. "My flat is quite small, so it's always quite fun when you just fill it up," she said with a laugh. "It just gets fun and sweaty." It might be why she was a perfect ambassador to a new way to party. Club living room, as her songwriting partner Coffee put it. Over the course of the spring, and between writing and recording songs for another album, which Lipa has already given a title, currently known by only a few collaborators, she left the flat behind for a while and went on a victory lap befitting a global star, with blockbuster performances at the Grammys and the Brit Awards, and a performance at Elton John's Oscar livestream that included two different high-colored Balenciaga gowns. And for the photographs for this article, she is shown in various high-fashion costumes. For an artist, something on the level of future nostalgia could represent the pinnacle of a pop career. It brought Lipa the respect she had been hoping for, while giving her plenty of opportunities to have fun, despite the difficulties of 2020. Now she's in uncharted waters, and it's up to her to find a place in pop's pantheon. On Oscar night, she stunned one of its longtime members. "She turned up so well prepared and was a joy to sing with," John told Vanity Fair. "Her musical chops are substantial. She has so much presence, an elegant poise and sophistication that belies her youth." "Dua," John said, "can go wherever she wants." So while her ongoing project of world domination is still unfolding, her aims for the near term are slightly more concrete. Two more albums and tours over the next few years. Lipa brought up acting or winemaking as things she might one day try, but emphasized that the music remains her focus. "I want to solidify myself as an artist in that aspect first, before anything else," she said. "For now, I just want to make sure the music is good."
Thank you.
The Mogul and the Monster by Gabriel Sherman. Of the many mysteries that still surround the life and crimes of Jeffrey Epstein, the source of his wealth, and thus his power, might be the greatest. His relationship with his most prominent client, billionaire retail magnate Leslie Wexner, holds the key. Opening photo, front row seats. Leslie Wexner, Jeffrey Epstein, and guest at a 2005 Victoria's Secret fashion show. In the fall of 1982, a money manager named Harold Levin got a phone call that would change his life. A lawyer representing Leslie H. Wexner, the founder and CEO of the women's apparel retailer The Limited, said Wexner was looking for a financial advisor. Would Levin be interested? Levin most certainly was. In Columbus, Ohio, where Levin lived, Wexner was a legend. Wexner grew The Limited from a single Columbus store into a global retail empire that included mall fixtures Abercrombie & Fitch, Victoria's Secret, and Bath & Body Works. Levin landed the job after 6 months of grueling interviews. He wasn't making Masters of the Universe money. Wexner paid a salary of $250,000 a year, but it was enough for Levin to move his family into a 6,000-square-foot house across the street from Wexner in Bexley, Columbus's most exclusive suburb. By 1986, Wexner ranked sixth on the Forbes 400 list of richest Americans, with a net worth estimated at $1.4 billion. In New York, I had bankers constantly taking me out to dinner, Levin told me. Once, a banker arranged a private tour of Le Bernardin. The kitchen was so clean you could eat off the floor, Levin remembered. Wexner entrusted Levin with increasingly ambitious projects. Starting in the mid-1980s, Levin purchased thousands of acres of farmland in New Albany, population 414, on the outskirts of Columbus, where Wexner planned to build his very own town, modeled on an 18th-century Georgian village. Les sent me to Richmond, Virginia, to look at architecture he wanted to copy, Levin said. On one of Levin's trips to New York in 1989, Wexner asked him to meet a brilliant young financier who wanted to pitch an investment opportunity. Levin had never heard of the man, Jeffrey Epstein, which was odd. After working for Wexner for 7 years, Levin knew virtually every player on Wall Street. A few months earlier, Levin says, he met with arbitrager Ivan Boesky. Levin's skepticism was confirmed as soon as he arrived at Epstein's Madison Avenue office. There were no visible signs of a trading operation, just Epstein sitting behind a desk that didn't even have a computer. Epstein was trying to explain a currency trade he wanted to do. I have an MBA from Ohio State, and I didn't understand a word the man said, Levin recalled. Levin went back to Columbus and reported that Epstein was a fraud. I told Les, stay away from him, Levin remembered. Wexner agreed not to do the trade. Levin was shocked when Epstein showed up in Columbus a few months later and announced Wexner had put him in charge of his finances. Levin tried to protest, but says Wexner wouldn't take his calls. Levin couldn't stand having Epstein as a boss. He was an asshole, the most arrogant person I ever met, Levin recalled. A few months later, Levin quit. Levin said Epstein taunted him on his way out. On my last day, Epstein walked into my office and held up a piece of paper. He bragged that Les had given him power of attorney over his money. I worked for Les for 7 years, and I never had general power of attorney, Levin said. Epstein, Levin continued, even ordered him to surrender equity in Wexner's town project, likely costing Levin millions. Epstein basically said, if you want, you can fight it out, but I have a lot of lawyers, and I'll make sure it'll cost you a fortune. Levin's life unraveled. He couldn't find a job. Friends told him Epstein was spreading rumors around Columbus and on Wall Street that Wexner had fired him for misappropriating funds. His wife filed for divorce, Levin said, and was granted custody of their three children. I had a nervous breakdown. I was living out of my car for a while, Levin said. He applied for jobs using computers at the library and showered at state parks. Epstein ruined my life. I lost everything, Levin said. 2 years after guards discovered Epstein unconscious in his Manhattan prison cell, the pedophile's life and mysterious death remain a subject of fevered speculation and conspiracy theorizing. Was Epstein an intelligence agent? A debased financial genius? A sociopathic con man who fleeced billionaires and politicians with sexual blackmail? In a search for answers, I spent the past 6 months investigating the Epstein mystery that could unlock others. How did he get his money? For it was Epstein's half-billion-dollar fortune that enabled him to sexually abuse and traffic hundreds of girls on multiple continents. There's no question that Epstein could not have done what he did without the support of people that provided him money, said attorney David Boyce, whose firm represents numerous Epstein accusers, including Virginia Roberts Giuffre. Epstein burnished his own myth, telling people preposterously that he only accepted clients with assets of $1 billion or more. But until recently, Epstein's only publicly named client was Wexner. When I ask Giuffre who else he worked with, he'd say, "I can't talk about it," an Epstein friend recalled. Wexner paid Epstein's predecessor about $600,000 a year in today's dollars. Epstein, a former high school math teacher from Coney Island, Brooklyn, was worth a reported $559 million. His estate included a 51,000-square-foot Manhattan townhouse bought from Wexner, a private jet, formerly owned by the Limited, and a helicopter, a Caribbean island, a Paris apartment, a Palm Beach mansion, and a 10,000-acre New Mexico ranch. Epstein's brother's real estate company also had majority ownership of a Manhattan condo building on East 66th Street, where Epstein allegedly housed girls. The building was formerly owned by Wexner. Prosecutors say that Epstein built his vast sex trafficking ring throughout the 90s and early aughts. In other words, Epstein became Epstein during his long association with Wexner. When Epstein pleaded guilty to 2 counts, including soliciting a minor for prostitution in Palm Beach in June 2008 and registered as a Level 3 sex offender in New York, Wexner refused to discuss him. In 2019, a Wexner spokesman told the Washington Post that the Wexners had severed all ties with Epstein in 2007. They condemned Epstein's actions, the spokesman said. It was only after Epstein died that Wexner described their relationship, and even then, in opaque terms. In Wexner's telling, he was another Epstein victim preyed upon by a devious mastermind. Being taken advantage of by someone who was so sick, so cunning, so depraved, is something that I'm embarrassed that I was even close to, Wexner said during a speech in September 2019. In a letter to his charitable foundation around this time, Wexner claimed Epstein had misappropriated vast sums of money from me and my family. Epstein had reportedly transferred back nearly $47 million to a Wexner-controlled charity fund in 2008. But Wexner's belated attempts to explain himself only raised more questions. Why, for instance, did Wexner not report Epstein's alleged $47 million theft to the FBI? Or how could Wexner claim to be blindsided by Epstein's duplicitousness? I told Les I wouldn't trust Epstein to cross the street. Why are you trusting him with your money? Recalled Jerry Merritt, a former Ohio State Highway Patrolman who served as the Limited's security chief for more than 25 years. In reporting this article, I spoke to more than 30 people who had firsthand encounters with Epstein or Wexner. Wexner, who announced he was stepping down from the board of his company in March, declined numerous interview requests. The story that emerged is a deeply strange one. Sources say Epstein occupied different roles in Wexner's life, depending on the audience. Jeffrey compartmentalized. He told you what you wanted to hear, Epstein's former lawyer, Alan Dershowitz, told me. Epstein sometimes portrayed himself as a surrogate son to a lonely billionaire. He told some people he was Wexner's fixer. Dershowitz said that when he became Epstein's criminal lawyer in 2007, Epstein boasted that Wexner would not testify against him. Whatever the nature of their relationship, Epstein's long-standing connection to one of America's richest men inarguably aided his public profile, adding to his air of legitimacy and thus his power. Wexner met Epstein sometime around 1986. They were introduced by Wexner's close friend, the insurance mogul Robert Meister, whose firm handled insurance for the Limited. I spoke with Meister in April, and he opened up for the first time about the origins of Wexner and Epstein's relationship. It was history that Meister, 79, found difficult to revisit. I walked away from Epstein a long time ago, and I've been trying to erase him from my mind ever since, he said. Epstein struck up a conversation with Meister on a commercial flight to Palm Beach. Meister remembered being impressed with the young banker. In reality, Epstein lived in a one-bedroom apartment and ran a fledgling investment firm. Epstein had been forced to leave Bear Stearns in 1981. He told Securities and Exchange Commission investigators he had been penalized after letting a friend borrow money to buy stock, that there were irregularities with his expense account, and that there were rumors at the firm about his relationship with a secretary. He was a great bullshit artist, Meister said. People who knew Epstein remarked at his savant-like skill at impressing powerful older men. Jeffrey was a flatterer, said interior designer Robert Couturier, who met Epstein in the 1980s. Jeffrey would call me every day and say, "Oh, you're so brilliant. You're the best." Epstein's friend Stuart Pivar, a founder of the New York Academy of Art, said Epstein's magnetism was almost impossible to resist. If you had hundreds of millions of dollars and you knew Jeffrey, there's a high likelihood that you'd give it to him. He was that good of a con man. In hindsight, Meister suspects Epstein aggressively cultivated him in the hope that Meister would open doors to his billionaire friends, like Wexner. Not long after Epstein met Meister, Epstein invited Meister to play racquetball and started turning up in the steam room at his gym while he was using it. "I'd be having a steam and Epstein would come in," Meister said. During one conversation, Epstein asked Meister to introduce him to Wexner. Epstein falsely said he had learned that Wexner's money manager was stealing from him. Epstein, a self-described financial bounty hunter, offered to help recover the funds. It was convincing enough that Meister arranged a meeting for Epstein at Wexner's house in Aspen. Epstein was such a liar, Meister said. In Wexner's 2019 letter to his foundation, he wrote that he hired Epstein because friends recommended him as a knowledgeable financial professional. Soon after introducing Wexner and Epstein, Meister started hearing disturbing stories about Epstein's sexual proclivities. Think of whatever the worst thing anyone could do is, and Epstein did them all, Meister said. The breaking point came when Epstein showed up unannounced at Meister's Park Avenue apartment with five models for Meister's sexual entertainment. Epstein thought he was bringing me a gift, Meister recalled. I told him, get the F out, and I never want to see you again. Meister, whose estimation of Epstein had done a total 180, gave his friend a general warning about his character. Meister says he and his wife, Wendy, warned Wexner to stay away from Epstein. We begged him, don't get involved, Meister recalled. It was too late. Wexner had hired Epstein as his financial advisor. He thought Epstein was brilliant, Meister said. Epstein claimed he could discern hidden patterns in financial markets, but his true money-making gift was reading people. He surely recognized Wexner was deeply lonely. Business was less his life, said Wexner's childhood friend Peter Halliday, whose Ohio bank prepared the Limited's first stock offering. Wexner was born in Dayton, Ohio, in 1937 to Russian Jewish parents who worked in the garment business. When Wexner entered high school, his family moved from Dayton to Columbus, where his father, Harry, opened a small women's apparel store called Leslie's. It was tough moving into a new community. Les didn't make a mark for himself, Halliday said. Wexner hoped to become an architect like Howard Roark, the libertarian protagonist of Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead. Harry insisted he study business at Ohio State. Les briefly enrolled in law school, but dropped out to work for the family business. As the story goes, Les wanted Harry to carry a limited inventory focused on casual clothes, and when Harry disagreed, Les quit. In 1963, Les opened the Limited with a $5,000 loan from his Aunt Ida. I built a business so I could create my own world, Les later told the New York Times. Within a year, Harry closed Leslie's and was working for Les. Wexner may have been CEO, but it seemed that his mother, Bella, was the boss. For 34 years, she served as the Limited's corporate secretary. A former executive recalled that Bella belittled her son in meetings when she didn't like his ideas. It'll never work. Don't do it, Bella would yell in front of his staff. I remember sitting there thinking, how dare this woman, the executive said. Les seemed to be terrified of Bella. According to Meister, Les would sometimes stay at Meister's house in Palm Beach, so that Bella, whose Palm Beach house was near Les's, wouldn't know Les was in town. He was afraid of her. She was running his life, Meister said. By 1976, the Limited operated 100 stores. 2 years later, Wexner risked bankrupting the company when he borrowed $30 million to acquire the logistics company Mast Industries, which operated a dozen factories in Asia and contracted with hundreds of others around the world. The gamble proved to be Wexner's genius move, akin to McDonald's revolutionizing fast food. By controlling production and shipping, Wexner globalized the apparel business. Wexner's core insight was that baby boomers viewed shopping as a form of entertainment. The limited supply chain allowed Wexner to rapidly roll out new clothing lines at lower cost and keep customers coming back. As shopping malls spread across the country, the limited boomed. Wexner went on an acquisition spree in the 1980s. He took over the Lane Bryant and Lerner chains. The department store Henri Bendel and a struggling Palo Alto lingerie store called Victoria's Secret. At the time he met Epstein, the Limited had an annual revenue of $3 billion. Despite the success, Wexner remained little known outside Ohio. Meister recalled a party in Aspen when Donald Trump walked up to Wexner and said, "Nice to meet you. Now how did you get so effing rich?" Wexner and Epstein soon became virtually inseparable. They were an odd pair. Wexner was in his late 40s, with a round face and big ears. Epstein was in his early 30s and dashing. From the right angle, he looked like Richard Gere. Les knows everything about me. He knows every experience I've had, Epstein once told a friend. Wexner's public image continued to grow after hiring Epstein. A 1989 Boston Globe profile that detailed Wexner's rise reported that his September 1st diary entry that year read, "I finally like myself." In a filmed deposition featured in the Netflix documentary Filthy Rich, Brad Edwards, a lawyer for some of Epstein's victims, asked Epstein if he had a sexual relationship with Wexner. Epstein denied it. Merritt, the Limited's security chief, was unnerved by the sudden friendship. Merritt recalled a weekend in the late 1980s when Wexner invited Epstein to shoot at targets on land Wexner owned in rural Ohio. Les had started collecting guns, but Les didn't know which end of a gun worked, Merritt said. Merritt recruited a world-class trap shooter named Jim Forsbach to teach Wexner to shoot. But, Merritt said, Wexner relied on Epstein. Epstein had this Magnum PI gun. He didn't know what he was doing. It looked like he'd never taken it out of the holster, Merritt recalled. Epstein was a social connector who populated Wexner's introverted life with glittery people. Novelist Christina Oxenberg remembered being invited by Epstein to a dinner party at Wexner's Upper East Side townhouse. Not long after, Epstein took over Wexner's finances. Les seemed like this rumpled, sweaty schlub. He was so ill at ease. And there was Jeffrey facilitating the conversation, Oxenberg told me. Dershowitz said the first time he met Epstein at the Martha's Vineyard home of Lynn Forrester de Rothschild, Epstein invited him to be a guest of honor at Wexner's upcoming birthday dinner. Jeffrey said something like, "For a present, my friend Leslie Wexner wants me to invite the most important man I met this year," Dershowitz recalled. The flattery worked. Dershowitz attended. Other guests included astronaut John Glenn and former Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres. Wexner's physical appearance changed. A former Victoria's Secret executive recalled Wexner dyed his hair. He hired a live-in personal trainer and adopted a new wardrobe. Les would wear the tightest jeans you saw. "I don't know how he didn't cut off blood supply to his private parts," the former executive said. Wexner's colleagues referred to this look as chairman's casual. According to sources, Epstein took an interest in Wexner's romantic life. In 1985, New York Magazine put Wexner on the cover with a headline, "The Bachelor Billionaire." Wexner dated, but the relationships didn't tend to last. Around the time Wexner met Epstein, Wexner broke up with a Columbus woman. According to sources, Epstein showed up at her house with a multi-million-dollar check and told her to stay away from Wexner. The woman declined request for comment. The friendship vexed Wexner's mother, Bella. Sources said she wanted Les to settle down and get married. Bella hated Epstein. She was so blunt, Merritt said. Around 1990, Wendy Meister introduced Wexner to a corporate lawyer in her late 20s named Abigail Koppel, who worked in the London office of Davis Polk, the Limited's outside law firm. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday night at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.